This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The July jobs report released Friday was underwhelming, and in the words of President Trump, the numbers were phony as he defended his decision to fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The president claimed, without providing evidence, that the numbers were rigged to make him look bad. But many economists expressed alarm at the firing, worried that it is now President Trump who is trying to manipulate the numbers.
President Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Israel. He said there's a deal in place to end the war, but the humanitarian concerns continue in Gaza. The Hamas-controlled health ministry says several people died of malnutrition in the last 24 hours, including a child. The manhunt continues in Montana for Michael Brown. Authorities say he shot and killed four people in a bar Friday in Anaconda. No motive was revealed. And more than 700 wildfires in Canada are impacting air quality for tens of millions in the upper Midwest. This is ABC News. Glenn Maxwell, the longtime partner of Jeffrey Epstein, who is serving two decades in federal prison, is moving to a different federal facility, says ABC's Stephen Portnoy.
Officials confirm the move from the low-security federal prison in Tallahassee to the minimum-security prison camp in Bryan, Texas. Ghislaine Maxwell had been at the Florida prison for 3 years prior to her meetings last week with the Deputy Attorney General. The facility houses both men and women. The Texas prison camp, on the other hand, is just for women. Other inmates there include convicted Theranos fraudster Elizabeth Holmes and former Real Housewives star Jen Shah, who pleaded guilty in a telemarketing scheme.
Fresh crew arrived at the International Space Station. Astronauts from the U.S., Russia, and Japan needed just 15 hours to get there from their launch from Cape Canaveral aboard a SpaceX capsule. They'll spend at least 6 months on the ISS, and a group that's been there since March will return to Earth on a SpaceX capsule this week. Brian Clark, ABC News.
My name is DeMar Hamlin. I play for the Buffalo Bills, and I play safety. CPR saved my life. I've teamed up with the American Heart Association as a national ambassador to help create a nation of lifesavers, turning bystanders into lifesavers through CPR education and access to AEDs. Nearly 3 out of 4 cardiac arrests that don't happen in hospitals happen in homes. Join me to ensure everyone has the chance to live longer, healthier lives. Visit heart.org/nation.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
It's fun to look back and laugh now.
That was a bad day.
There are marriages that have died on less. Our first actual fight as a married couple was about the house rules of playing Monopoly. We've not really played Monopoly since. When you can modify an app, you can modify the rules of the game. Maybe there are times when you are better off just playing the computer. Play something else with your spouse instead.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. A new report shows Wisconsin again falls behind the national average in per-pupil spending for public schools. Experts say a 2-year funding freeze in the current state budget ensures the decline will continue. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum study shows the state spent less than $15,000 per student in 2023, nearly 10% less than the national average. Joellen Pauls is a retired Middleton Cross Plains special education teacher. She says the state of public school funding in Wisconsin is an ongoing crisis that the current state budget guarantees will continue.
There is no per pupil increase for 2 years. No increase. That's a funding freeze. And that puts a lot of districts in a hard place scrambling to determine how do we even just get through this school year.
Among Midwestern states, Wisconsin ranked first in per-pupil spending on public schools back in 2002. According to the report, its ranking has since dropped to 7th among Midwestern states and 26th nationwide. In the past 5 years, more than half of Wisconsin's public schools have held referendums to allow districts to increase property taxes to cover basic costs for schools. Pauls says where those referendums have failed, districts face difficult decisions about increasing class sizes and reducing staff.
Honestly, it's an insult to the students in our public schools. And for lack of a better word, it's irresponsible. It's a shirking of our legislators' duty to our communities and to our state's future.
She says student mental health support and special education continue to be poorly funded in the current state budget. Wisconsin was also grappling with losing $72 million due to a federal K-12 funding freeze, but administration officials now say they plan to release those funds. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some smoky, hazy sunshine, highs near 80 degrees. Mid-50s tonight under mostly clear skies. For Sunday, sunshine and a high near 80. Monday, mostly sunny, a high near 81. Tuesday, mostly sunny and a high near 84.
It's 57 at our studios.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Civic Media News Director Sholly Pittman will join us to break down all the weekend news. We go beyond the cheese with Poppy Bakery. Join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, I am honored, I am delighted that you have chosen to spend some portion of this weekend in conversation, in discussion, in information sharing with me and my producer Max about those major issues in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. That, as always, our mission here on Amicus, a Law Review. Part of our mission, too, is to engage you in that very discussion. That includes the option that you always have to call in at 855-752-4842. That telephone number, one more time, is 855-752-4842. You can also be a part of our broadcast by sending to me and to Max a question, a comment, an observation, an inquiry that you have about anything on our always ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus in the area of rule of law. Do that by dropping your comments into our studio chat line here on the Civic Media broadcast stations. We do have indeed an ambitious yet achievable syllabus for you this weekend, this first weekend in August of 2025. Let me tell you a bit about the kinds of things we're going to discuss. Again, focusing a lot on the Department of Justice, focusing a lot upon courts, in particular this weekend, some very interesting late week actions by the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. That's way out west there, that basically very broad swath of territory in the western part of the continental United States of America, also including Alaska and Hawaii. We'll talk about some things the Ninth Circuit has done. We're also going to chat about these important events happening to do with the Voting Rights Act, and in particular, this new talk once again about redistricting and gerrymandering. You know what we're talking about. That has to do with this initiative now underway in Texas to carve out some new district lines when it comes to the House of Representatives, going to be voting for 435 members across the nation to be sent to the House of Representatives in November of next year. The legislature in Texas proposing the creation of new lines that would dramatically shift, likely, the political balance there in that state, prompting responses by governors in California and Illinois and New York to do the same thing. All of that going on while the Supreme Court is, yes, once again, looming not just in the background, but very much in the foreground of all this, case called Louisiana versus Calais, which they decided not to decide. We'll talk about a major thing that the Supreme Court told us about how they're going to entertain that case in the coming docket the coming docket of the 2024, 2025, and then 2026 term. I say all of those because it began in this past and present term, going to continue into next year as well. We'll chat about exactly how the Supreme Court is defining that much-related case, the Louisiana case having to do with racial gerrymandering there, what impact it could and may have on what's going on in Texas and arguably these other states. That'll so happening in the midst of the Court of Appeals deciding in the exercise of its emergency docket to stop the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in connection with its prohibition on private parties and private entities suing and litigating under the Voting Rights Act. That's a lot of things going on just this past week and in recent weeks having to do with redistricting, line drawing, congressional seats, the balance of power going into November of next year, and also the ways in which the Supreme Court has historically and now likely in the coming year or so is going to be revisiting once again the very constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act and Section 2. We'll talk a bit about Shelby County again and Brnovich, those cases in the past in which the Supreme Court has significantly curled back the application of the Voting Rights Act, all of that coming out of these redistricting issues and gerrymandering issues, now very much on the rule of law docket of America. Also on the docket, you may be surprised to know this, but our tariffs, yes, indeed, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the president's actions that have animated a lot of his initiatives since he took the White House and was sworn in January of this year. Believe it or not, and you should believe it, there is now a connection, a very strong connection. There always has been between the rule of law and something called the International Economic Powers Act. We'll talk about that act, and we'll talk about what one federal court is saying now about the capacity of the president to do all of this tariff work that he has been doing, breaking virtually every day, every hour, including just late this past week. We'll tell you about things related to the major questions doctrine, the non-delegation doctrine, all kinds of things coming out of an oral argument of just this past week involving the Federal Circuit reviewing a lower court decision that says that the president does not have the authority to engage in all of this activity in which he has been engaging with foreign countries with respect to tariffs and levies and like economic issues. It's a significant move, not a decision yet, but certainly an indication that the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals is going to announce fairly soon that the president is without constitutional authority to do any of this. We know that from the Constitution as well, that provides that the legislature and not the president is the one that at least initiates and makes decisions principally on tariffs. We'll talk about that as well. We're going to begin, in addition to talking about federal district court judges and appeals court judges, also addressing once again the issue of birthright citizenship. Lots of activities going on there, including, yes, again, in appeals courts on opposite sides of the country, addressing the issue, yes, that the Supreme Court failed to address in its decision of late June, that having to do with birthright citizenship. A lot on our docket. But we do begin. We are going to begin today in our discussion of the rule of law and government and justice in America by talking about not just the rule of law, but also, yes, indeed, the rule of facts. The rule of facts. People in the areas of history and economics and commerce and labor and justice and international relations have always talked about the notion that in order to establish a nation that relies upon the rule of law and the application of jurisprudential principles enforced by courts, affording people the litigation opportunities to challenge what government is doing. Not only do you have to have laws that are followed and observed, that's the rule of law, but also the rule of facts. And that if indeed an American population, the population of any country on the face of the planet, cannot fundamentally agree on core facts, not all the small details around the edges, but the core things that happen in America, the big ticket issues, the things that grab the headlines, if we cannot agree on those, and apparently we can't. If you can't agree on those, you have a lethal combination, if indeed the rule of law is not applied to understood and known facts. And in fact, we've got two instances where the rule of law perhaps remains in place in many places around our nation, even as it is suffering hugely from the assaults made by our present Department of Justice, and yes, indeed, our president as well, but also this past week, more indication on attacks on the rule of facts, on the basic understandings that necessarily undermine the very integrity of the rule of law. Let's talk about those two issues that once again may surprise you in terms of our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review. As always, you may be a part of this discussion at 855-752-4842. Two issues, two events coming out of Washington, D.C. just late this past week. They are rule of law issues, but they're also rule of facts issues. One of them happens to do with the Smithsonian Institution. You know this quite well. The National Museum of American History removing references to President Donald Trump's two impeachment proceedings. That coming out of an exhibit that perhaps many of you, if not all of you, have seen, called The Limits of Presidential Power. A Smithsonian spokesperson has confirmed to media just this past week that the museum, interestingly, curiously, shockingly, has decided to restore, in its words, the section of a permanent exhibition. It's been there for a long time. I recall seeing it in 2008. We're going to go back to the appearance of this particular exhibit in 2008 because they said various topics had not been updated since that year, and therefore they removed references to Donald Trump. Now, they promised that in some point in the future there's going to be some new incarnation of this particular exhibit, but they went on to say that in reviewing our legacy content recently, it became clear that the limits of presidential power, the section of our American presidency portion of our museum, needed to be addressed. The section of the exhibit covers Congress, it covers the Supreme Court, impeachment and public opinion, things we talk about a lot here on this broadcast. The exhibit now only includes reference to the impeachment proceedings against Presidents Andrew Johnson, that was 1868, and Bill Clinton in 1998. And then it also makes reference to an unimpeached president. He was about to be impeached. And yes, impeachment proceedings were underway with respect to Richard Nixon in 1973. Not impeached, he resigned, as you all know well, before he was impeached, before the Senate could try him. We have had four impeachment proceedings, not including Richard Nixon, Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and yes, two Donald Trump impeachments. And those two impeachments of Donald Trump no longer a part of that presentation at the Smithsonian Institution in the American History Museum. Again, a promise from the curators there that's going to be revised and restored at some point down the road, but not today. And so if you visited, as those museums are open to the public, that one right there on the Mall, within walking distance of the Congress, of the legislature, of the White House, yes, indeed, within, frankly, yards of the Department of Justice building right there on the Mall of Washington, D.C., a compromise in the rule of facts because no longer is there reference there to the impeachments that did, in fact, happen. Impeachments and trials in the United States Senate, just like those of Andrew Johnson, like and those of Bill Clinton, those two, and those now removed from the official American History Museum in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, removing some critical facts about our recent history and effectively erasing them, at least for now, whitewashing them from the ways in which our major presentation of the Smithsonian is presented to Americans, young, old, of all backgrounds. That happened just this past week. And then in something that you may think is unrelated, has to do with the Department of Labor, also in the category of the rule of facts, and an attempt to try to undermine, perhaps just for the future, but the all-important erasure of the work and the activities of a civil servant who is responsible every month providing us with basic Labor Department information. She did that just late this past week, and she has lost her job, sending a message to the future about the ways in which our president anticipates reporting being made. As we come back, we'll talk more about the lesson of that emission of the rule of facts when Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go, always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus. This is our two-hour weekly weekend broadcast reviewing all things rule of law, justice-related, a lot of focus on government and courts, the executive branch, the legislative branch as well, and this broadcast, no exception to that. As always, taking your phone calls not only on our studio chat line through the auspices of Civic Media, but also on the phone, 855-752-4842, beginning our discussion with some focus on the rule of facts related to the rule of law and much related to our discussion this weekend as well. Not only the Smithsonian whitewashing, removing at least for now references to the impeachments of the current president of the United States of America. Some of those, again, of past years, but nonetheless recording until this past week the history of our nation when it comes to the power of the presidency and the rule of law impacts of impeachment proceedings with respect to three presidents, and they are Clinton, and they are Johnson, and they are Trump. Again, Richard Nixon facing impeachment, not formally impeached. That happened this past week, and as did this. In a seemingly unrelated event, but no less significant in terms of eliminating facts and suggesting that the data upon which we all rely may indeed be compromised. You know this story well. President Trump again unleashing disagreement, maybe even fury, about the weakness in the labor market that was reported, as it is done every single month at the start of the month, saying without evidence that the data, the latest data about the strength of our economy was rigged. That's his word. And that he was therefore firing the Senate-confirmed Department of Labor official who's responsible in a nonpartisan, nonpolitical way for putting together the numbers every single month. We rely on those. Economists rely on them. Reporters rely on them. Students rely on them. Commerce relies on them across the board. In a long social media post, President Trump said that he had directed the firing of Erica McCanterfer, McCanterfer. She is the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS. She's inside the Department of Labor. And once again, what does she do? She produces every month in a non-political, nonpartisan way numbers. She is, it reduces her very important role to some less significance by saying she is a number-crunching accountant, but that is one way of describing her very important role. She does more than that. She is a professional. She has been around for a long time. She was confirmed on a bipartisan basis by the United States Senate in 2024. A long career inside the Census Bureau, other agencies doing the same kinds of things, working with numbers, economic statistics. She has served under the presidency of both parties, including Donald Trump, among the Republicans who voted to confirm her. So a fellow named J.D. Vance. He was a senator at the time. He's now our vice president. The president firing her this past week because he does not like the report, the monthly data report that showed a surprisingly weak July when it comes to hiring new jobs in America. Also, a large downward revision of the jobs growth reports in May and June. That's not unusual. That is the revision of reports as the final data comes in. All of that indicating that the economy is not as strong as some believed. Economists widely interpreting the report as some evidence that the policies of this administration, always difficult to ascribe particular downturns to what's going on in the immediate moment, but an awful lot of indication that the policies of this White House beginning to take a great toll on our economy, although the president insisted in a subsequent post following his announcement of the termination of Commissioner McCanterfer, that the country was doing great, capital key G, capital R, capital E, capital A, capital T, with an exclamation mark. Now, why is that important? Why is that significant? Are there other economists? Are there other people out there? Are there people who have got that experience who can do the job? There may be a handful of them, but this is a sign of more of the compromise of the rule of facts. Again, absent facts, we've got no justice, we've got no government upon which we can rely, and indeed an awful lot of economists across the board, across partisan divides, are seeing this as being an erosion of the public confidence that all of us can have in the data published by the administration, by this very reliable group of people who provide us with information, who tell us truthfully what is happening and what is not happening in our economy, prompting, yes, policy responses, prompting presidents, and yes, indeed, groups like the Federal Reserve should prompt the Congress as well to do things, but relying upon facts. And it is a sad moment, once again, when there in Washington, D.C., the president is terminating someone, not because she's incompetent, just the opposite. She is professional and reliable and respected across the board. We're firing her as a sign that somehow the information that she has provided is not accurate, rigged, as the president has inaccurately, violently stated with respect to our data. And that signals a future upon which we cannot rely upon the data produced by someone who may be told by this president, you produce information, you produce this monthly labor data that is not reflective of the true numbers in front of you. Give me numbers that show that the economy is doing better. That is contrary to the rule of facts. It denigrates as well the rule of law in America, as does what happens across the mall there at the Smithsonian Institution and in other places in Washington, D.C., when the facts of our nation and the information that we need to rely upon to make decisions. We can disagree about policies, but we need to be able to rely upon a common set of facts. Senators in the past have talked about relying upon facts as being core to our deliberative process, even though you can have different opinions about what we do. That is the problem, and that's the compromise we are seeing in Washington, D.C., and from this White House just this past week. When we come back, we're going to go back to more of this White House and more of courts, beginning with the Jeffrey Epstein matter, some further commentary on that as we continue here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The July jobs report released Friday was underwhelming. And in the words of President Trump, the numbers were phony as he defended his decision to fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The president claimed, without providing evidence, that the numbers were rigged to make him look bad. But many economists expressed alarm at the firing, worried that it is now President Trump who is trying to manipulate the numbers.
President Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Israel. He said there's a deal in place to end the war, but the humanitarian concerns continue in Gaza. The Hamas-controlled health ministry says several people died of malnutrition in the last 24 hours, including a child. The manhunt continues in Montana for Michael Brown. Authorities say he shot and killed four people in a bar Friday in Anaconda. No motive was revealed. And more than 700 wildfires in Canada are impacting air quality for tens of millions in the upper Midwest. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers still on top. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers face the Nationals in game two of their three-game weekend series in Washington, D.C. Last night, the crew won 16-9. It looked like batting practice. Home runs for Andrew Vaughn. William Contreras with a home run and a career-high five hits in a single game. Blake Perkins with two home runs. The Cubs won at home, 1-0 over Baltimore, in a game that was over in just 1 hour and 49 minutes. NFL Family Night tonight at Lambeau Field. Over 70,000 expected to attend. New linebacker Isaiah Simmons played for the Cardinals and the Giants before joining the Packers. Reminds him of being in college at Clemson.
I ain't never had that many home fans at a game coming from Arizona and New York. It's just pretty cool. Like I said, it reminds me a lot of Clemson. Like our spring game, we would have like 50,000 people there. You know, it's just really giving me a feeling of like kind of being back home at Clemson, which is a really good thing.
As Packers linebacker Isaiah Simmons with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some smoky, hazy sunshine, highs near 80 degrees. Mid-50s tonight under mostly clear skies. For Sunday, sunshine and a high near 80. Monday, mostly sunny, a high near 81. Tuesday, mostly sunny and a high near 84.
It's 57 at our studios.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
NFL Hall of Famer, College Football Hall of Famer, Mr. Joe Thomas. You were telling us a little bit about being drafted number three. You skipped the draft.
I went fishing that day, and I never did it for anything other than I just much rather spend the day fishing with my dad, and I'm hoping that that's a story that keeps being told and gives people a reason. Like, you know what, instead of working today, I'm going to go fishing with my kid. I'm going to make the time because it's impactful. It's memories that they're going to remember for the rest of their life.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day, when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at MDA75.org.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Every 15 seconds, someone is diagnosed with cancer. If it's happened to you or someone you love, the American Cancer Society can help at every step of the journey. Visit cancer.org today.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome actor and producer of the Door Kinetic Arts Festival, Alan Kopischke, into the studio. Then Appleton Bookstore owner, Kaylin Bavink, joins the show. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for once again joining me in this, the first of our two-hour program this weekend, talking and beginning the substance of our discussion with topics that we left you with last weekend and the weekend before, and that is the Jeffrey Epstein matter. As I have bemoaned on a regular basis, it is sad. And it is commentary on our national focus, both in the media, in Washington, D.C., and other places, that while we've got major issues, yes, related to immigration and education and health care and foreign affairs and agriculture and commerce and labor and all those other things that government should be attentive to, not instead, not completely replacing that, but in major portion, our branches of government focused upon Jeffrey Epstein. Let me explain in further detail the reason for my great concern about the focus in three different areas. We're going to be speaking a bit in greater detail about first, these files, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of those. We're going to talk necessarily then about the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America. His name is Todd Blanche. Why his recent conduct in the midst of this, what the president has called a hoax, in fact, is simply an unfounded and unformed conspiracy within a conspiracy. We'll talk about why his conduct should be the subject of concern, head scratching, if not more, by all Americans. And then, yes, indeed, we're going to talk about Ghislaine Maxwell. She is also in the news just this past week, not only because of where she is now been moved to a new, very low security prison of the Bureau of Prisons. We'll talk about all those three things, much related. We're going to talk about prisons. We're going to talk about pardons. I'm going to talk about something called use immunity that I mentioned in our program of last week as well. Let's begin, however, by doing a little bit of history. You recall well that the president a number of weeks ago announced that he was going to order the release, or at least order his Department of Justice to seek the release of all the grand jury materials. And we knew from the start, as we talked on this broadcast, even as our attorney general and our deputy attorney general signing off on a request for the release of those documents, they're not Department of Justice documents, they're court documents, and for that reason needed to go to the court to get permission under Rule 6C to release them. We knew from the start that that application was frivolous, and indeed we know based upon the reporting that we provided on this very broadcast, others as well, that Judge Robin Rosenberg looked at that and said, no, there's no legitimate law enforcement reason to release those. The attorney general knows that, the deputy attorney general knows that, and therefore they're not released. And of course, giving the president some reason to say, see, more judges who are standing in the way of doing what I want to do. In fact, the judge abiding by the rule of law, and more beyond that, acknowledging implicitly, if not explicitly, the grand jury materials are not the kinds of things that are going to satisfy anybody out there with respect to these unfounded conspiracies. What are the grand jury materials about? They're about the basic facts upon which the indictments of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were premised. They're going to talk necessarily, I'm sure, about the specific events in which they engaged, where they did this, the island issues, the recruitment of young girls to engage in this horrific behavior, the horrific behavior of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the victimization, the survivors of much of this behavior, although there have been deaths related to this as well. It will tell you all about those kinds of things that ultimately a grand jury looked at and said, yes, indeed, a basis for charges. It is not those grand jury materials. It is not a package of things going to provide support for what Dan Bongino, our deputy director of the FBI, has made much of his career on. That is that identifying that somehow inside all of this, there is some masterful conspiracy that maybe involves Hillary Clinton, involves the suicide of Jeffrey Epstein, and wanting to get inside that, not inside the grand jury materials, that would not be there. And frankly, moving on to the more recent issues, the files themselves, which are apart from the grand jury materials, including things like what are called FBI 302s, reports of interviews of people coming forward, certainly reports of the victims, survivors of this horrific activity perpetrated by Maxwell and Epstein as a part of their sex trafficking, their human trafficking, victimizing these young girls. That's in the files as well. Presumably, there'll be notes. There'll be all sorts of other arguably surveillance issues and matters presented in those reports. There'll be matters related to the basic information, and that will probably, maybe include things that the Department of Justice has also confirmed in that now infamous memorandum unsigned of many weeks ago, saying things that are necessarily have to be true. That is, number one, that Jeffrey Epstein, after his indictment, based upon the grand jury presentation, based upon all that file information, committed suicide inside the Bureau of Prisons. That a tragedy as well, as is all of this, and also a matter for horrific behavior and conduct by a Department of Justice and the in particular the Bureau of Prisons that permitted somehow, without being sufficiently attentive, the death of an inmate in their custody. That is horrific in and of itself. Nonetheless, the findings of that, which could be inside the files, not telling you anything more that we don't already know. That is that Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. And that is the tragedy also related to this matter. It will also certainly tell you that there's no magic. There's no small black book here that lists the particular clients. There may be names there, and maybe you can cull through that. But the reality is that even the files themselves are not going to give you an awful lot of information beyond what the facts are related to the case. And maybe in the end, maybe through the Congress, which is now spending all this time on this matter as well, issuing subpoenas, sending letters, demanding that the Department of Justice release all this, I suppose in the end, to bring this frivolous conspiracy stuff to an end, it would not be a bad thing to release those by the pen of our attorney general. She can do it, even with the redacted names of the victims and perhaps others out there. But the upshot of all of this, it's not going to support any of these conspiracies within conspiracies. No QAnon basis for any of this. And again, as we talked last time about this concept that the simplest explanation of seemingly complex things is often the most rational. And that is certainly the situation here. That's number one. The files, arguably released in the future, maybe released in whole or in part, simply not going to satisfy anybody because they're not going to reveal as investigative materials the kinds of conspiracies, the hoaxes, whatever that means, Mr. President, inside this investigation. That's first. Second, we have Todd Blanche, who is our deputy attorney general, doing something extraordinary, atypical, perhaps unprecedented by any other deputy attorney general in our nation's history. We know as a regular portion of our work as investigators out there that it is agents, sometimes accompanied by assistant United States attorneys or attorneys in the Department of Justice, but it's the agents of the FBI, the special agents who are skilled in interviewing and do this routinely from the FBI, from the ATF, the DEA, all of the other investigators investigative federal agencies and indeed sometimes state agencies as well that will sit down with witnesses and talk with them and get their statements and prepare those documents, and again, including 302s. That's the number of the form that the FBI uses to record the information provided by witnesses. That's the stuff that's included in that non-grand jury file sitting in the Department of Justice, probably electronically. We know that that is done routinely by whom? By federal agents, and not by the second in command of our Department of Justice, who has as his responsibility what? The duty to take care of the day-to-day operation of the Department of Justice. Many, many different units, many, many different investigative components, lawyers and staff and professionals responsible for making the Department of Justice go. The Deputy Attorney General does not go out there and become an investigator until now. And so we've got Todd Blanche going to, at the time, the location of Ghislaine Maxwell in Tallahassee, a prison facility of the Bureau of Prisons, and talking with her, apparently over 2 days, about what we don't know, presumably about other information that she have, which is also the other reason why this is so curious. The case is done. She has been convicted. She has been sentenced 20 years in prison. Yes, it is indeed an outrage that somehow in the midst of all of this, somehow she has been moved from a high security prison to this place in the Bureau of Prisons, in a prison camp, a minimum security prison camp in a place called Bryan, Texas. Bryan, Texas, with virtually no perimeters at all, limited or no perimeter fencing, and that is where she is today after speaking 2 days, to the Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche. And the question is, what is this about? What are we doing here? The case is done. Her conviction, yes, indeed, she wants review by the Supreme Court. We will see what, if anything, they will do with that. They shouldn't be reviewing that. But her case is done, and her conviction should stand. And yet the Deputy Attorney General going there, why? Because he was also in the past the private attorney for the president, who plainly wants to produce some information that maybe, what, exonerates him, implicates others, not for in law enforcement purposes, not for the reasons that the federal judge identified as being legitimate, but for political purposes and partisan purposes. It is occupying his time and his focus based upon this past attorney-client relationship that continues to this day, even though he's no longer representing the president in that famous, that infamous trial in front of Judge Juan Merchan, in which the president was in the end convicted, lest we forget, of 34 counts of violations of New York state law, a conviction that still stands to this day. That was the setting in which Todd Blanche had an attorney-client relationship with a man who's now his boss. That attorney-client relationship necessarily continues, even as the Deputy Attorney General has the responsibility first and foremost to what? To the people and the country of our nation. Now, that has been changed, obviously, by him, by the Attorney General, who say we're all now working for the president, and yet it raises huge conflict of interest issues for him, for Todd Blanche, continuing to know things said to him by the president in confidence, presumably about matters related to sex and power in that case in New York, and now another case involving sex and power, and that is the Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking, human trafficking tragedy, but nonetheless now resolved, presumably gathering information not for any legitimate law enforcement purpose, which should be his focus every single hour of every single day, but rather to respond to what were presumably the requests of his former client, who happens to now be the president of the United States of America, asking information from her. We'll see what comes of that. We do not know, but it is curious and it is problematic. And then we have Ghislaine Maxwell herself. And as we go into the final component of this hour, we'll talk more about what is going on there. We'll talk about a thing called use immunity and the basis upon which she was presumably permitted to go ahead, what that means in talking to Todd Blanche, what she wants out of this, and why the notion of a pardon or general immunity is also hugely problematic inside this broad issue that should not be consuming the time and attention of our nation and our elected and appointed leaders. All that coming up here on Amicus. A lot of you.
As Wisconsin is summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Americans really like voting by mail and in-person early voting. That, according to 2024 statistics from the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. According to EAC, 158,211,780 citizens voted out of 211,144,275 active registered voters, a 74.8% turnout, 3 points lower than 2020. Among the 158 million voters, 52.8 million voted in person on Election Day. But far more Americans voted early, with 46.8 million voting early by mail and almost 48.9 million voting early in person. Mail-in voting accounted for 30.3% of votes cast, with some states offering universal mail balloting or permanent mail or absentee lists. Over 15 million ballots were returned via drop boxes in 36 states, up 10% since 2022. The percentage of in-person Election Day voters dropped in 2024 to only 37.4%, while in-person early voting jumped to 35.2%. The combination of mail and early in-person totaled 65.5%. It's clear that early voting is here to stay. We've linked to the report at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Frank Anderson, who is the founder of Wisconsinology.com. You were great in the documentary. That's really exciting.
I'm really not as a documentary filmmaker because I get bored so quick. You have to really dig into your subject, and you got to show up every day sometimes for years to let a story unfold or to find the story. I'm good for one day.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is the final segment of our first hour talking necessarily, but with some frustration about this issue that just doesn't seem to go away in the life and now the lifeblood of American history, and that is this Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell matter. We talked about the fact that the grand jury materials, the paper files, the electronic files out there reveal the investigative results, which we know because they've been the subject of a trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, not of Jeffrey Epstein, because he committed suicide before that happened. We know that those files, whatever the content, whatever the depth of them may be, are not going to provide any support for any broad conspiracy or hoax of the sort that people like Dan Bongino, the deputy director of the FBI, used to talk about. but our president also calling this some kind of hoax involving another political party other than his. We know that that's the case. We know that we've had this very curious event in which our deputy attorney general has spent 2 days, hopefully not alone, but maybe, according to some reports, alone, becoming a witness himself to things that Ghislaine Maxwell has now told him about over the period of 2 days inside a federal prison in Tallahassee, Florida. We don't know exactly what the purpose of that was, but we can make some legitimate guesses, and that gets us to Ghislaine Maxwell herself, who plainly is interested in getting out of prison. She has requested immunity from the future prosecution of any law enforcement authority, including presumably that of the Department of Justice. And she has asked for a pardon, presumably, to our deputy attorney general. And plainly, our president has not dismissed that as being out of hand. Let's talk about all of that. Now, we know that she was given something called use immunity. What is that all about? It means basically this, that Todd Blanche went there and said, we will talk with you under the condition that nothing that you say to us will be used, thus the word use, will be used against you in any future prosecution. Not entirely clear what that prosecution would be all about, but often used by prosecutors in other cases to receive and get information by defendants, by targets, by subjects. If indeed it is believed that they've got useful information for what? For a future or continuing prosecution. That helpful information that only they can provide about other events, other people involved that the present Department of Justice, the present prosecutors, do not know about. That's a grant of use immunity. If you sit down and talk with me and give me that information, I, as a prosecutor, will not use that against you. I can still prosecute you on the underlying events that you described, but it's got to be based upon something other apart from what you tell me in this sit-down meeting. I will not use the information that you provide against you in that prosecution or that further investigation. That was the deal, apparently, upon which my deputy attorney general and yours sat down with her. And so she's seeking, presumably, some further assurances that if she talks more or maybe even has already given up all that information, that she will get from the president of the United States of America a pardon. She's asking the legislature again for blanket immunity, complete immunity for anything that she may say. If indeed she's subpoenaed there, she's asking for the sun, the moon, and the stars should not be granted, not be given by any legislative body, should not be granted by the executive branch. Let's talk about pardons. Pardons, again, traditionally inside the Department of Justice, operated by, administered by the Office of the Pardon Attorney. Their basic principle has been, if you have been convicted and sentenced 5 years ago and you acknowledge what you have done and you've made good in your life, you've done other things to show that you are no longer that person who committed those crimes of the past. You've done something for the community, for yourself, for your family, for your friends, for people out there who've made the world a better place, involved with you because of the work that you have done since your conviction. Clemency, in the literal sort of the word, a sense of jurisprudential sympathy, if you will, and a grace which the Supreme Court has described, bestowed upon you for the things that you have done, not forgiving, not overlooking the past, but saying that your conduct has been appropriate to get you that pardon. The Office of the Pardon Attorney has traditionally looked through those applications which come through that Office of the Department of Justice and made recommendations to the president about whether a particular applicant, a petitioner, is entitled or should be entitled to a pardon. Now, we know that that's not always been followed, and certainly past presidents have run roughshod over that process. This particular president has done that, as have past presidents, including the firing not too long ago of the pardon attorney who's responsible for the administration of that very office. Her name, Liz Oyer, O-Y-E-R. She no longer has a job. She's a former federal defender. She knows the process. She knows the system. The president fired her. Why? Because she was not giving him a positive recommendation about whether or not Mel Gibson's gun rights should be restored. Remember this story? She is gone. And so the president has gotten rid of the person responsible for the operation of the very office that should be doing this deliberative, nonpartisan review of applications, presumably running roughshod if indeed the Elaine Maxwell matter is now afoot between the Department of Justice and the White House, running roughshod over those traditions of the Office of the Pardon Attorney that have guaranteed some regularity and some systemic understanding about how pardons will be implemented. This, too, should be a reason for concern among all Americans who are looking at this mess, which is the Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell matter. If indeed the president grants her some kind of immunity or clemency, a pardon, if in fact the Congress in some way goes along with that, we are really putting the rule of law and, yes, the rule of facts as well, not only in a secondary seat, but a tertiary seat, maybe far beyond that when it comes to the administration of justice. And all to what end? All to what end? Certainly not the promotion of justice, not the administration of the rule of law, and not the kind of thing that has been a regular pursuit of presidents and attorneys general and prosecutors and investigators committed to the rule of law in our nation's history. When we come back, we'll talk about redistricting, we'll talk about tariffs, we'll talk about birthright citizenship, all that coming up on this, the second hour of Amicus. A Law Review.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Trump announced plans to build a $200 million ballroom at the White House. His administration says Trump and donors will pay for the renovations. Reporters asked the president Friday if that would include foreign donors.
You have very strong restrictions as to who can donate, and we go by the restrictions.
The president also said he made the right decision when he fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, saying without evidence her numbers were phony. That firing came hours after the disappointing July jobs report. Steve Witkoff, the president's special envoy to the Middle East, is meeting with hostage families in Tel Aviv. He says there is a plan to end the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. The manhunt in Montana continues for Michael Brown, who authorities say shot and killed four people in a bar in Anaconda on Friday. And more than 700 wildfires in Canada are affecting air quality in the northern U.S. This is ABC News.